Hello, and welcome to our listeners around the world. You're listening to JAMA Evidence, our podcast series based on core issues in evidence-based medicine. Today, we're discussing the issue of external events that cause modifications or terminations of clinical trials. I'm your host, Dr. Roger Lewis, Senior Statistical Editor for JAMA and editor of the JAMA Guide to Statistics and Methods series. I'm here with Professor Maria Brooks. Professor Brooks, could you go ahead and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My degree is in statistics, and I'm a professor here at the University of Pittsburgh in the Department of Epidemiology with a secondary appointment in the Department of Biostatistics. That's part of the School of Public Health. I also am one of the co-directors of the Epidemiology Data Center, where most of what I do is coordinate clinical trials or multi-center cohort studies.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, in your article, you talk about the challenges associated with unanticipated external events that impact the conduct of an ongoing clinical trial. Could you go ahead and set up the scenario for which we're going to be talking about what people should do?
Sure. We work so hard to design a study, to start to conduct the study, and then sometimes bad things happen. And we're not talking about things like an inability to recruit as it planned or data not turning out as clean or in the right direction as what we had anticipated. But rather, we're talking about events that occur outside of the trial. And these could be several different types of events. They could, for example, be things like the COVID pandemic impacting our ability to deliver treatments the way we thought we could deliver them, or information from other trials that impact how, again, we could deliver treatments to certain populations, or even lack of funding at the drop of a hat, which could happen because the funders no longer are able to fund a trial. So things that happen from the outside that impact the way we conduct the trial and how to respond to those changes.
So you mentioned that these are bad things that happen, but actually sometimes they're good things. For example, we might be studying a treatment for a disease that is very difficult to treat or associated with lots of morbidity or mortality, and a trial external to the one we're involved in might actually demonstrate that there's a new treatment that should be used, drawing into question the appropriateness of the control group that we've utilized. So let's talk about that example and maybe talk a little bit about the specific example that you mentioned in your article.
So you're absolutely right about that. It's all in perspective, right? That often these are good things, that advances are made in science and you're incorporating the advances into the study. The example that we talk about in our article, and I should give credit where credit is due, this is an article that's really about the CONSERVE reporting guidelines. So in a way, we're reporting on two different articles, right? We are reporting on these guidelines that exist, and maybe you'll cover that later. And then we're applying them to an example of a clinical trial that was ongoing. So a clinical trial that was ongoing was the CODEX randomized clinical trial. And it was looking at a drug to increase potentially the number of ventilator-free days for patients who have had COVID. As they were doing the trial, another trial announced that this drug was quite effective. And as a result, through the decision of the Data Safety Monitoring Board, it was recommended that the trial stop. They accepted those conditions and indeed terminated the trial based on entirely the external evidence. And so had to report the results from their study with fewer participants than had been designed.
So obviously the publication from the recovery trial that demonstrated the effectiveness of corticosteroids in this setting was a major advance for the treatment of the disease at the time. So it was good for people, but very inconvenient for the trial that was ongoing. So you also mentioned that after they published their report, there came out a set of guidelines for how to handle situations like this. And in your article, you apply those guidelines to the report of the trial that was terminated early, the CODEX trial. And even though it's not fair to apply criteria that didn't exist at the time they had to write their report, they actually did quite well. So let's start by talking about the conserve guidelines and what the basic principles are regarding how we should handle these types of situations.
Absolutely. And so it's worth understanding that there are a series of guidelines that exist, and there are the consort guidelines and there are the spirit guidelines. And so these guidelines exist to try to help us standardize the way we report either trial results or the trial design. And I think they really have helped those of us in science publish in a way that others can understand what it is that we've done when we conduct a study. And so these conserve guidelines were intended to build upon both the consort and the spirit guidelines and saying, how should you both handle and most importantly, report results when these external events occur and change the way you are conducting your study? And so they had a large group of well-experienced trialists that they came to a consensus and created guidelines that included as well a flowchart and checklists to help you be able to go through the various steps of the process.
So essentially, they created a roadmap for best practices in this unanticipated setting. Is that fair?
Absolutely. That's well stated.
One principle that's so important in ensuring the validity of a clinical trial is that of pre-specification. The challenge for the trialists in this setting is you can't possibly pre-specify what you're going to do in response to events you couldn't possibly have anticipated. So, given that we can't have pre-specification in this setting, what do the conserve guidelines lay out as the basic principles to increase the degree of validity of the trial that we can preserve?
I think partly it's complete reporting, asking that you explain what the extenuating circumstances are, describe how any modifications that occur due to these circumstances are important, and their impacts on the trial in terms of the mitigation strategies that the trial had to take in order to accommodate these circumstances. And so again, it could be the population that is appropriate for the clinical trial. It could be the interventions and how they are delivered in the clinical trial. It could be the amount of follow-up. For example, in the obvious case of termination, that you have reduced follow-up or information, and the timeline in which you're activating each of these changes. The other part then they talk about is to try to clearly articulate who knows what at what stage of the decision processes. And that's the part that is, I think, very difficult to do. But the more we can be transparent in those ways, the more valid our results and credible our results are in terms of acting upon them. The last part is the interim data part. And so when we have modifications, making sure again that it's articulated who has what interim data at their disposal as they're making decisions and how those data are used as we go forward.
You specifically mentioned the importance of knowing who knew what at the time decisions were made. Why is that so important?
We try to minimize biases as we think about the design and conduct of any study. And so if you're aware, for example, that you're very close to being able to prove that one treatment is better than another, and you're making a decision, should you stop the trial, you may be tempted to say that stopping it soon would be preferable to stopping it immediately. Something of the sort. That might be an extreme example, but those kinds of things happen frequently in terms of unconsciously making decisions based on the data that we know to put the study that we're conducting in the best light possible. And so the more we can reduce biases, the more the data truly reflect truth rather than be shifted or biased in one direction or another by our decisions.
And just to clarify, this is one of the reasons why decisions regarding conduct of a trial by investigators need to be made without those investigators being aware of the interim results, certainly interim results that include comparisons between treatment groups.
Absolutely. And I think the word masked is the common term that we use, that the investigators who are in the position to make study design and important conduct decisions should remain masked to the accumulating data, as you say, particularly by treatment group as they're making those decisions.
So in your article, you specifically talk about how the termination of the CODEX trial was handled. Could you describe for us a little bit how that was done, and specifically with respect to the approach that's recommended by the CONSERVE guideline?
Sure. So as the trial was going on, as was noted, external data were available from the recovery trial. And we applied these CONSERVE guidelines, and we should definitely emphasize that we applied them retrospectively. And so you might take argument about the appropriateness of doing so, but it was a great illustration to help us see how to apply these well, because in general, they did a very good job in terms of reporting things, was to describe the extenuating circumstances. And in their article, they have a whole section on the early trial termination, and they talk about the information that they got from the recovery trial and how what they call their DSMC reviewed the data and based on the data determined it was unethical to continue. So that was terrific. Next, they have to think about the modifications. And so they do describe the obvious modification here is that the trial is terminated. As noted, many trials may instead change their eligibility criteria or change their comparator group or other kind of differences as they go forward. Termination is probably the easiest to describe. But then they have to talk about the impacts and those mitigation strategies as they go forward with the trial termination. And here again, they talk about how those who are in active follow-up were terminated, but they don't discuss how some of these things were handled in terms of communication or treatment, et cetera. This is one area where it felt like maybe we could have understood better how participants were advised about termination and how they were treated moving forward. Then they talk about how the modifications were reviewed. This was the part that's most difficult because it really is a challenge the way the structure of trials with their data safety monitoring boards are set up. As noted, there's a wall, and the data safety monitoring board does have access to ongoing interim data, whereas the investigators do not. And yet, once a data safety monitoring board recommends stopping a trial to the sponsor and even to the study investigators, it's very difficult to not proceed with that recommendation. And of course, they knew about the recovery results. So the DSMB did have access to interim data. It's not clear how that played in. As it turns out, the CODEX results for the primary outcome of ventilator-free days did have a significant benefit, whereas a secondary but very important outcome of mortality was not significant. Understanding how those might have shifted just slightly, depending on how quickly decisions were made to terminate, it's unknown, but it is unlikely that things would have changed in any dramatic way given the circumstances for this trial. So overall, it seems that the way, again, they reported how interim data were handled, how they proceeded with their analyses, it was done in a very transparent way so that we understand the progression over time from learning about new results, terminating their trial, and then reporting the results and the data that they have in a reasonable way.
Let's talk for a moment about the importance of this topic. Why is the issue of termination of clinical trials and how to do it as well as possible so important right now?
At the moment, we're hearing about trials that are being terminated, and we want to make the most of the resources that have been put into those trials. In addition, we have a contract with the participants as they sign their informed consent and they give their time and their energies into participating into a clinical trial that we use the data to the best of our abilities. And so we want to report the information and knowledge that we gain from a clinical trial, but we also want to do that free of bias so that as others continue to do research, they can use that information in the best way possible as they move forward.
So from your point of view, what are the most important takeaway messages from the CONSERVE guidelines and from your article?
First of all, that external events occur as you do a study. None of us do studies in isolation. And so things happen within the trial, but things happen outside of the trial as well. And they impact the way we do the trial. So when these external things happen, we can make decisions about modifying or terminating the trial. We want to make the most of the information that's been gathered through our trial, both in terms of benefiting the resources that have been put into the trial, as well as value for future clinical research that comes after the trial. And most importantly, making sure that we're transparent about the way we report what has occurred in terms of the external events, how they impact the trial, and how we responded to those events so that the appropriate conclusions can be drawn based on the data from the trial.
I am Roger Lewis, and I've been speaking with Professor Maria Brooks about terminations of clinical trials due to external events. You can find a link to the article in this episode's description. This episode was produced by Daniel Masisi at the JAMA Network. To follow this and other JAMA Network podcasts, please visit us online at jamanetworkaudio.com or search for JAMA Network wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
This content is protected by copyright by the American Medical Association with all rights reserved, including those for text and data mining, AI training, and similar technologies.